the middle chapter now of the three in the unit. And there's a couple important historical experiments and developments that we need to talk about in this chapter, including this first slide. Let me just, before going through what's really happening on the slide itself, tell you that we haven't really known for all that long what DNA is and how it works. I mean, everyone recognizes DNA nowadays, and even without taking a biology class, nearly everyone knows that DNA is involved in heredity. Well, we have known as humans for millennia, way older than science itself, that parents pass traits on to offspring. That's been obvious for a long time, right? We had no idea until fairly recently how that happened. But it kind of makes sense that there must be some genetic, or there must be some material of inheritance, a particle of inheritance. But like I was saying on the other example, it's not enough to just say it makes sense. You have to actually pin it down to say that it's true. And that wasn't done throughout human history until fairly recently, within the last 80 or 90 years. Actually, less than that, as far as pinning it down. But though most biologists agreed that there must be some particle of inheritance, it's a much different thing to actually demonstrate what it is. But first, you have to figure out what it is. You first have to say, experimentally, you have to demonstrate that there definitely is a substance or a particle, a material of inheritance. And this first slide is important historically because it demonstrates that, kind of indirectly. This is the so-called Griffiths experiment that was conducted in the, I'm thinking 40s, but I can't remember, it doesn't matter. Anyway, this experiment's famous for a couple reasons. One is that it is the first experiment to demonstrate what is called bacterial transformation. I'll explain what that is in a minute. But in this experiment, bacteria are used and mice, unwilling mice are used. Non-volunteer mice, I mean. But the bacteria that were used come in two strains. There's two different strains of them. The so-called S strain and the so-called R strain. S here stands for smooth because of how they look under a light microscope. But the S version, it's basically the same species, but two different categories of in that species. The S strain is the dangerous stuff because it causes pneumonia. Whereas the R strain does not. It's not virulent. All right, so let's look at what they did in the experiment. They took some living S cells, that's the dangerous ones, injected them into the mice, some mice, and not surprisingly, those mice died. No surprise. Also not surprising is the second condition. They took some living R cells, those were the harmless ones, and injected them into other mice, and they lived. So that's not surprising either. And neither is the third one, where they took some S cells, which are the dangerous ones, but before injecting them, they heated them up, made sure they were all dead. Well, dead dangerous cells don't kill mice, right? Living ones do. So these mice lived as well. The interesting one is the fourth group, where they took heat-killed S He killed dangerous ones. And then they mixed them with living, harmless R ones. And then that mixture was put into the mice, and they died, even though there were no living S cells, which are the only ones that are dangerous. And so what happened, we now know, is bacterial transformation. Transformation is a way for bacteria to take up naked DNA from the environment. By naked DNA, I'm talking about DNA that's no longer in cells. Cells that have died and ruptured and spilled their DNA out into the environment, so it's just DNA that's molecules, can, under the right circumstances, be taken up by DNA into their cell, taken up by bacteria into their cells, and they can start using them as though it's their own DNA, like they had it the whole time. And so it's famous as an experiment for showing that this first time that this was demonstrated, but it also indirectly shows you that there is a particle of inheritance. Because something was transferred from the dead S cells to the R cells to change their traits. They now have the dangerous trait, right? And so that doesn't say at all what it is, but it tells you that there is a particle of inheritance. So that's back in the 40s. Now, as soon as those results were published, the next big question, of course, once you've shown that there is a particle of inheritance, is what is that particle, right? So that's a bunch of people were working on that for a decade, trying to figure it out. Well, it could be just about anything, chemically speaking. But to try to cut down the work, try to make progress as quickly as possible, a bunch of materials were kind of put to the side and not really counted as serious candidates for being the genetic material, like water molecules, for instance. So it's very unlikely that it's water molecules, or any small molecule for that matter. So most biologists just assumed as a starting point that it was probably one of the four macromolecule classes that we've talked about. So at this point in history, we knew that nucleic acids existed. We knew that those chemicals were in organisms. We just didn't know what they did. Right? So we knew already that there were polysaccharides, polypeptides, nucleic acids, and lipids as the four macromolecule classes. And I figured it's probably one of these four things that is the particle of inheritance. Well, then they cut it even further. They said it's probably not lipids because they're not really all that complex, right? They're not polypeptides. I mean, they're not polymers, right? And they also, for various reasons, discounted polysaccharides as probably not being the material of inheritance. It's mostly fuels, and there's other reasons for discounting them as well. And so that leaves the other two categories, right? Nucleic acids and proteins. Well, at this point in history, most biologists assumed that it was going to be proteins. They basically reasoned that for anything to control something so complex as heredity, it must itself be a complex particle. So they said, almost certainly it's going to be proteins. Well, you can't just say that in science, right? You have to demonstrate it. But they also included in their possibilities nucleic acids simply because they didn't know what other thing those nucleic acids did. They knew proteins did certain things. They knew all three of the other categories of macromolecules did various things. They knew nucleic acids existed, but they had no idea why. So they said, well, let's include those too in the tests. All right. So they narrowed it down basically as a starting point to proteins or nucleic acids. And that brings us to another important experiment done, like I said, about a decade later in slide two. This isn't the experiment itself, but it's important to the background of this. What you see here in teal, these three cartoon alien-looking things, are three copies of a virus. And the brown that they are stuck on is just a little piece of a big bacterium. Well, big in this view. We're really close up here. A bacterial cell, remember, is tiny compared to a normal cell of your body, and a virus is much tinier still. Now, these viri are examples of a category of a viral category called bacteriophages. Notice the same root as in phagocytosis, meaning eat, right? A bacteriophage is not a bacterium. A bacteriophage is a virus. It doesn't eat a bacterium. That's why it's named that. It's a virus that invades a bacterium. All right, now, a virus is not an organism. It's not alive. Why is it not an organism? That's true, and why doesn't it have a metabolism? It's true that there is no nucleus, but a nucleus is just part of what? What is the structural unit of life? Where does metabolism occur?
In a cell.
The strict minimum requirement for being an organism is that you have to have at least one cell. You can have one or more cells. A virus isn't close to a cell, right? In fact, a virus like the ones pictured here is really just two of the four macromolecules. It's a nucleic acid, in this case DNA, wrapped by a protein. Okay? It doesn't do anything on its own. It doesn't have any metabolism. It can't reproduce itself. Living cells, though, are able to make copies of the virus, and that's how it gets reproduced. Well, this is exactly why the scientists for this upcoming experiment I'm about to describe chose bacteriophages as their subject. Because as I said earlier, they're trying to figure out what the genetic material is. They've narrowed it down preliminarily to protein or DNA. And they chose bacteriophages because that's the only thing bacteriophages have. They are just DNA and protein. You can see in this figure that it's labeled as DNA that's being injected. That's the genetic material. But they didn't know what part, the protein or the DNA, got injected. That's what they had to demonstrate. Okay, we know now that DNA is genetic material, but this is before we knew. Anyway, this is why they chose bacteriophages. Now let's go to slide three and look at how this experiment was designed. This is a very elegant, very well-designed experiment. They needed a way to be able to tell at any part, they need to be able to track or tell where the protein was as opposed to the DNA. Okay? And so they had to label these two different kinds of materials. And they used what's called radio labeling because they used radioactive isotopes of the elements involved. So there's two batches of liquid in this. This pink one uses radioactive sulfur. That's the only kind of sulfur. S-35 is radioactive, and therefore, since it's radioactive, we can detect the radiation coming from it, and we can tell, therefore, where the sulfur is. Why did they use radioactive sulfur? Very good choice, because there is no sulfur in DNA. Whereas there is sulfur in proteins. Not every amino acid has sulfur, but some amino acids have sulfur, right? And therefore, proteins, which are made of a bunch of amino acids, have sulfur in them. Well, if you have nothing but radioactive sulfur in the environment, and you allow a few generations of these viruses to be replicated by the bacteria that are in this solution, then they have to make the protein that is the part of the capsule out of that radioactive sulfur. So that labels the proteins, but not the DNA. Meanwhile, in the blue batch, they use radioactive phosphorus, also a very good choice. Why did they choose phosphorus? Because DNA has a lot of phosphorus in it, right? DNA is millions of nucleotides. Each individual nucleotide has a phosphate group in it, which has a phosphorus atom in it. So, however big or small DNA is, it has plenty of phosphorus atoms in it. So the radioactive phosphorus labeled the DNA, but not the proteins. All right? Those are the two batches, pink and blue. Then they just let these labeled viruses invade more and more bacteria and inject the genetic material into the bacterium. They just didn't know what it was. That's why they labeled it. Then they had to have a way to break off the shells after the injection of the genetic material, the capsules of the virus. They needed to break those off of the surface of the bacterial cells. But they needed to do it in a way that would not kill the bacterial cells. So they needed something to stir this vigorously enough to break off these empty capsules, but not burst open the bacterial cells. And it turned out that the perfect tool for that was just an ordinary bar blender. So that's what they used. Okay, so now you have the pink and the blue mixtures, which just consists of, both of them consist of the same thing. Still intact living cells that have been injected with viral material, plus just empty viral capsules. Then they, from each batch, they spun a sample of that in a centrifuge. That creates very high G forces, and therefore the heaviest stuff in the tube falls to the bottom, making a pellet. Well, the heaviest stuff by far is the actual cells, the bacterial cells. And the lighter stuff that floats above it, called the supernatant, is where the empty viral shells will be. That's where it pays off that they label these things, because in the two batches that have been centrifuged, they look for the radioactivity. And in the pink one, they saw radioactivity in the supernatant. The empty shells, therefore, contained the protein, not the DNA. In the blue batch, the radioactivity was in the pellet where the cells are. And this said it's the DNA that was injected, not the protein. And therefore, it is DNA that is the genetic material, not protein, as most, against what most biologists at the time figured would happen. They figured it would be protein, but it ended up being DNA. And as a matter of fact, it shows you something about human nature. Some of the biologists at the time said, okay, well, what you have demonstrated that DNA is the genetic material for bacteria, but for something as complicated as a human, I still say it's protein. Well, eventually they came around, and we all know that it's DNA for all organisms, no matter how complex or simple. Okay, so let's go on to 4 and talk about the structure of DNA a little bit more detailed than what we have already. This is not a complete DNA for a couple reasons. One is that a complete DNA has two strands, and we're looking at just one strand here. Another reason it's not a complete DNA is that just a single strand of the two that are in DNA is much, much longer than this. This is only showing you four nucleotides worth, which is why it fades off on the ends. But it would really be millions of nucleotides long. It's an enormous polymer. So, but what we have here is just one polynucleotide, one polymer of DNA formed by hooking together the monomers called nucleotides. And one nucleotide is labeled on the bottom, but each of these is a nucleotide. And remember what are the three requirements for being a nucleotide. A nucleotide consists of three parts, one of which is a pentose sugar, right? A five-carbon sugar, in other words. And there's two choices of sugar for nucleic acids, but not if you're going to build a DNA. If you're going to build a DNA, then that pentose has to be deoxyribose, specifically. If you're going to build an RNA, which is also made out of nucleotides, then the sugar is going to be ribose. And however long the polynucleotide is, the sugar is the same in all of the nucleotides. It's always deoxyribose for all of them in a DNA, and it's ribose for all of them in an RNA, however long it is. But anyway, that pentose sugar is one of the three components. You also then have to have two things hooked to it. On one side, you have a phosphate group, and all phosphates are basically the same. So within one nucleic acid, within a DNA, there is no variability with respect to sugars or phosphates. They're always the same. The third component, though, is a nitrogenous base. And that's the only reason that there are different kinds of nucleotides in DNA. Because the sugar is always the same, the phosphate is always the same, the nitrogenous base is the only thing that can be different. And that's the reason why specifically four nucleotides are shown here, because they're showing you the four different nitrogenous bases that DNA usually uses. Adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. Now, the nitrogenous bases, since they are the only things that vary, because the sugar doesn't vary, the phosphates don't vary, they are the only reason that DNA is carrying information. It's an informational molecule, DNA. Well, what is the information? The information is the specific sequence of nitrogenous bases. Right? That's what serves as a code, the specific sequence. And that information, of course, is important. That sequence matters. That is the information. If you lose the sequence, you've lost the information. So this is why it's really important for a strand of DNA, one DNA polynucleotide, to stay together along its length. Because if it gets broken into pieces, then you've lost that sequence. You don't know what that sequence is anymore. Well, what you see here is that the nitrogenous bases, which actually give the information to the molecule, are not at all involved in keeping this thing together along its length. The nitrogenous bases are not connected to each other within a strand. Instead, they're hanging off of the blue highlighted part, which is the part that is holding it together. This blue highlighted part is the sugar phosphate backbone. So this is one individual nucleotide to start with. This is one individual nucleotide to start with. And they're hooked together with a covalent bond between the phosphate of one nucleotide and the sugar of the next. And that's why this pattern over and over, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, all the way down, is called the sugar phosphate backbone of the polynucleotide. That's what maintains the integrity of the code. It keeps it from being lost because these are covalent bonds. These bonds between a phosphate and the sugar of the next nucleotide are called phosphodiester bonds. Notice that this is very similar to what happens in a polypeptide. A polypeptide is a polymer made out of amino acids, right? And the only thing that holds the amino acid sequence together along its length are covalent bonds, peptide bonds, between the amino group of one amino acid and the carboxyl group of the next amino acid. And the R groups, which are the only thing that differ between different amino acids, so they're just like the nitrogen spaces, they are not at all hooked together. They just hang off of that back bone. Similarly here, nitrogenous bases are just hanging off of the backbone, not holding it together at all. However long a polynucleotide is, one end of the entire strand is the so-called 5' end, and the other is the so-called 3' end. These are named for the carbon of the sugar that's in that position. So the oxygen atom is part of the sugar. That's why it's labeled as O. Remember, if a corner or a bend is not labeled, it's a C, but if it's labeled something else, it's a different atom. This one is not carbon, it's oxygen. But you can kind of think, since O looks like a zero, that kind of think of that as a zero and then start counting your carbons clockwise from that. 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the fifth one is not part of the ring, it's hanging off the ring. So that's where the phosphate is. Whether it's a single nucleotide or whether it's an entire nucleic acid strand, the 5' end features a phosphate. The 3' end features just a hydroxyl, OH, as you see here. All right, now notice that there's four overall normal DNA nitrogenous bases, the ones listed here. But whereas they all four nitrogenous bases feature rings, two of them, thymine and cytosine, feature just one ring, and the other two, adenine and guanine, feature two rings. And therefore, there's two categories of nitrogenous bases that we'll talk about pretty soon. First, though, back to this history. So now we're at the point, after that second experiment, of realizing that DNA is the genetic material. So now the question is no longer what is the genetic material. Now the question is, now that we know it's DNA, what does DNA look like? Because in order to figure out how DNA works, you first have to know what is its structure as a molecule. That was the next burning question, which didn't get answered until the mid-50s. And it was answered by several different people that collaborated, including Watson and Crick, which got immediate fame, and they got the Nobel Prize. But they couldn't have done it without the help of Rosalind Franklin, who didn't get any credit during her lifetime, and she died when she was only 37 of cancer. So she didn't get any credit at the time, but modern textbooks now finally give her the credit. They were all important, but Rosalind Franklin's contribution was that she was an expert in what is called X-ray crystallography, which is a way of figuring out the shapes of molecules. It's called X-ray crystallography because you have this molecule you don't know the shape of, and you shine X-rays, which are light, just invisible light to us, onto it. And then behind the molecule, you have X-ray sensitive film. And depending on the shape of the molecule, the X-rays will be bent in different directions before they hit the film and make the image. So you have here a famous image that doesn't look like much to us. But to Rosalind Franklin, these patterns told her this looks like it could be a helical structure to me. And that's what she told Watson and Crick. And so they started trying to figure out how they could build a model of DNA in a helical shape. And there's a famous picture of them in their lab building one out of tin, and that's what they got the Nobel Prize for. So we can see that double helical shape in slide 6 on the left. This is one DNA, but remember, one DNA is really two molecules, right? Because the two individual strands of DNA is each a complete molecule. Each strand is a polynucleotide. And those two polynucleotides of a single DNA are complex together. The blue in this double helix represents the sugar phosphate backbone of one polynucleotide, one strand, and the sugar phosphate backbone of the other strand. Each of them is in a helix shape, which is a corkscrew shape. And each of them has nitrogenous bases just hanging off of that backbone, not involved in keeping it together along the length. But notice that there is an interaction between nitrogenous bases of the two different strands. And so the sugar phosphate backbones in their helix shapes with these nitrogenous bases hanging off together form what looks like a spiral staircase. All along the length, however long it is. So that's the real shape. But to make it easier to think about and look at, you can mentally untwist this spiral staircase, and that's going to form it into what's like a ladder, right? If you take the twists out of this, it'll just be a ladder, like you see in the middle of the page, middle of the slide. Do you have a question?
Yeah. Do they only attach to strands that are of the same length, or would you ever have one that's attached to a longer one?
The truth is that they are slightly different. Well, no, they're not the different lengths. It's easiest just to say they are exactly the same for now, even though that technically that's kind of a lie. But no, it's not by accident, and we'll see the answer to this pretty soon. Not today, probably, but the next time. The reason that they both exist is because one is made from the other. And that's why they correspond. Now that is, then that's part of what I was just getting to by looking at the ladder view, which is the uncoiled version. So this is just part of the overall sequence. But what we see here is that the sugar phosphate backbone of each strand is holding it together. Each strand has polarity, meaning that there's a 5' end and there's a 3' end that are different from each other. I said that the 5' end is where you have the phosphate sticking off, and the 3' end has a hydroxyl. That's true for each strand. But the two strands that make up one DNA have what is called an anti-parallel arrangement. What that means is that it's kind of head-to-toe arrangement. The 5' ends are not at the same end on the two strands. Notice that the left strand here has the 5' end at the top. Well, that's the 3' end of the other strand, and the 5' end is down at the bottom. So it's like this, not like this. That's what anti-parallel means. Now, what holds these two strands, which are separate molecules, right? Each is a complete polynucleotide, each strand is. What holds them together is represented by pink dots in this figure. Those pink ellipses, or sets of three dots, are hydrogen bonds. Hydrogen bonds between nitrogenous bases of different strands hold the two strands together. So this is very similar to a multimeric protein. Remember that a multimeric protein is one that consists of at least two polypeptides that are held together somehow. Well, each polypeptide is by itself a complete molecule, right? But in a multimeric protein, there's multiple ones, at least two, that are hooked together somehow, but even though they're still separate molecules. Here you have exactly two, not two or more, DNA strands, DNA polynucleotides, that are held together by hydrogen bonds forming between nitrogenous bases at the same position but on opposite strands. Okay, now, one very important aspect of DNA is that it's not just hydrogen bonding between the two strands. It happens in a specific way. And that specific way is called complementarity. Complementarity is the noun, or we say that the two strands are complementary to each other. What that means is that wherever you have an adenine nitrogenous base on one strand, at the same position you will have a thymine on the other strand, and vice versa. Wherever you have a guanine on one strand, you'll have a cytosine at the same position on the other strand. So it's always A with T, T with A. It's always C with G, and G with C. That's what complementarity means. So a DNA double helix is complementary. Its two strands are complementary, and its two strands are anti-parallel with respect to their direction. Okay, now let's go to slide 7 and talk about the categories of nitrogenous bases. This brings up another important scientist in this history, which a guy called Chargaff, who spent a lot of time studying DNA from all kinds of different organisms. Bacteria, plants, animals, anything he could get his hands on, he would extract the DNA from these and then test it chemically. And what Chargaff noticed is that regardless of what species he took this from, what kind of organism, he always found that the amount of purine equals the number of pyrimidine. So what are these two words? Well, they're categories of nitrogenous bases. I said there's four nitrogenous bases used in DNA, but remember, just a couple slides ago, I said that two of those four have one ring in them, and two of those four have two rings in them, right? The nitrogenous bases, represented by just the rings here without their names. Well, the ones that have just one ring are called pyrimidines. The nitrogenous bases that have two rings are called purines. And I used to confuse these all the time, and then it finally dawned on me something that hopefully will help you as well. The word pyrimidine, notice, has a Y in it. And so does thymine and cytosine. Those both have a Y in them. And those are the two pyrimidines. So that's how I finally kept it straight in my mind. Guanine and adenine don't have a Y, and they are the purines. Okay? Now back to Chargaff. He noticed that the amount of purine always equaled the amount of pyrimidine. Well, this figure shows you why that's true. In this latter, so this is untwisted again, in this latter analogy, a base pair, which is a pair of nitrogenous bases from the two strands, represents one rung of the ladder, right? Well, if you were allowed to mix and match and have any kind of nitrogenous base with any other kind of nitrogenous base on the other strand, then you could have two purines together, you could have two pyrimidines together, or one of each. But since the purines have two rings, they're wider. And if you use a purine with another purine, that would be a wide rung of the ladder. You use two pyrimidines, it's going to be a narrow rung of the ladder. So instead of having a normal ladder, you would have zigzags, right? You have variable lengths along the length. And that's why it doesn't happen. If instead you always use one purine and one pyrimidine, it doesn't matter which side is on which side. Which one of those is on which side, that is. You're always going to have the same overall width of the rung. And therefore, you have a nice straight ladder all the way down the length. So that explains part of complementarity. That explains why there's always a purine with a pyrimidine. And that explains why Chargaff always had the same amount of each, no matter what DNA he tested. But that doesn't explain all of complementarity. Because it's not only true that a purine is always with a pyrimidine, it's more specific than that. It's always adenine with thymine and always guanine with cytosine, which is more specific than just purine with pyrimidine. Well, that's explained in slide 8. This is strict complementarity, meaning not just purine with pyrimidine, but specifically thymine with adenine and guanine with cytosine. So what you see here is that both adenine and thymine, adenine is the purine, thymine is the pyrimidine. With this particular two, adenine and thymine, they can both form two hydrogen bonds. And with this pair, guanine and cytosine, they can both form three hydrogen bonds. And that's why those specific two pairs are what actually happen in real DNA. It's not just purine with pyrimidine, it's specifically adenine with thymine, guanine with cytosine. And Watson and Crick's paper, which is pretty short but really famous, when they figured out the structure of this, they noticed this strict complementarity. And what's really one of the most huge understatements in all of science, they ended their paper with just a simple sentence saying something like, "It has not eluded our attention that this complementary nature of DNA hints at there being a mechanism for replication." And that's exactly how DNA is able to replicate itself, because of this strict complementarity. And that's also to finally answer your question why one strand is always the same length as the other, because they are complementary in nature. Well, we can see that in slide 9. The fact that there is strict complementarity, meaning A always with T, T always with A, C always with G, G always with C, means that if you have two strands of a DNA and you split the two strands apart and hide one from me and just show me one strand, whatever the sequence is in that strand that I'm able to look at is enough information to tell me exactly what the sequence is in the other strand, right? All I have to do is put a T where there's an A, C where there's a G, and so on. So what this means is that strict complementarity is a way for each strand of DNA to serve as a template for how to build a copy of the other strand. Right? Whatever the sequence is of one strand tells you how to build the sequence that makes up the other strand. Well, blue, dark blue here represents original material. Light blue represents brand new material, DNA that's being built by hooking together nucleotides. And what happens in DNA replication is that the two strands are separated. Each individual strand is separately read the sequence of, and that sequence is used with the rules of complementarity to build a complementary sequence to each of the two strands. And by the time you're done with that, you now have two double strands that are identical to each other. DNA copies itself because of this complementarity. And another important part of this whole thing, it gets back to what I was starting to talk about when I said that it's important for the sugar phosphate backbone to be made of covalent bonds, because otherwise you would lose the code, right? It needs to be held together along its length. But just as important, the bonds that hold the two strands together need to be weak, which is why those are not covalent bonds, those are hydrogen bonds. Individually, very weak, right? There's millions of them, so it holds the two strands together nicely. But you have to be able to separate the two strands for each of the two major functions of DNA. What are those two functions? Right. Transcription is using just one gene, which is just part of the overall sequence. You want to build a protein, so you go to the library, look at one gene. Well, to transcribe a gene means to read the sequence in that part. And in order to read the sequence, you need to have the two strands separated so you can read that one strand. Replication reads the whole sequence, right? But to do that, you also have to have the strands separated from each other. So it's important for the thing holding for the bonds holding the two strands together to be weak, and they are. Just as it's important for the bonds to hold the thing together along the length, need to be strong, and they are, because they're covalent bonds. All right, let's stop there.